Okay, let's get started here. We're already a couple of minutes behind, but this is the session where we welcome the really true and faithful who are willing to get up this early in the morning and come to the very first session at Sunstone, which is, as always, a devotional session. And this morning, our session is entitled Faith, Doubt, and Belief: The Epistemology of Testimony in the New Testament and Today. And we have somebody who is very familiar with the New Testament and I think can speak to us with some authority. Our speaker this morning is Michael Vinson, who I was just chatting with him out in the foyer and learned that he lives in Star Valley, Wyoming, but he deals in rare books and such, and also owns a bookstore in Idaho Falls. In his little bio, he tells us that he's taught gospel doctrine classes for over 10 years. He served a mission to Bolivia. He has two master's degrees, one from BYU in history and from the University of Chicago in history of the book. He's worked in a rare book library at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. As I mentioned, he's had his own rare book business for about the last 15 years. And last year, he attended a two-month seminar on Greco-Roman influences in the on the New Testament, which was taught at Tyndale House, which is part of St. Edmund's College at Cambridge. And he also spent 2 weeks studying the cities of Corinth and Ephesus in Greece and Turkey. So we're looking forward to hearing from Michael Vinson. Please go ahead.
Thanks a lot, Paul. What he didn't mention was I'm going to collect another master's degree. I'm entering a program this fall in the Divinity School at Cambridge University, and I'm looking forward to that. My patient wife puts up with my collecting of these little degrees along the way. What I would like to do this morning is have a discussion, and I would like to use the story of Thomas as a starting point. I'd like to go ahead and give some background, some information on the story of Thomas, commonly known as Doubting Thomas, the poor fellow, through the ages. And then use that to discuss a couple of things that might affect people today. And so as we're going through this, I'd like you to reflect on what we're talking about and think about what you could contribute to the discussion this morning. Well, I'll go through a little information about him first. Let's begin just by reading the story in the King James Version. In John chapter 20, verses 24 to 29, and then we'll elaborate on this after we read it. But Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. The other disciples therefore said unto him, We have seen the Lord. But he said unto them, Except I shall see in his hands the print of the nails, and put my finger into the print of the nails, and thrust my hand into his side, I will not believe. One of the things I would like you to reflect on and think about is the conditions that Thomas wanted to put on his belief. Think about that in terms of a condition, and then what we're going to talk about after we discuss Thomas are the types of conditions that people might put on their willingness to believe today. For Thomas, he wanted to touch and feel. He had to, that's what he wanted in order to believe. But let's think about how that might apply today as well. And then we'll just go here. And after 8 days, again, the disciples were within, and Thomas with them. Then came Jesus, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst, and said, Peace be unto you. Then saith he to Thomas, Reach hither thy finger, and behold my hands, and reach hither thy hand, and thrust it into my side, and be not faithless, but believing. And Thomas answered and said unto him, My Lord and my God. Jesus saith unto him, Thomas, because thou hast seen me, thou hast believed. Blessed are they that have not seen, and yet have believed. Now, as I mentioned, I think Thomas gets a bit of a bad rap here. His name in Hebrew means twin. Didymus in Greek means the same thing. There must have been a brother at some point. The only other time he really appears, a significant appearance in the New Testament, is in John chapter 11, verse 16, when Jesus learns of the sickness or death of Lazarus and wants to go to Bethany. And the other disciples are very reluctant at this point. because Bethany is only 2 miles from Jerusalem. They're going to be close to the high priest, to the temple. There's a possibility of arrest or something else. And Thomas is the one who speaks up at this point. When they're apparently the disciples are having a little debate among themselves about whether or not they're actually going to go to Bethany and see Lazarus, who's probably dead anyway, they're thinking. And Thomas speaks up, and we get a little more idea of his courage, I think, at this point, or his resignation. You can take your pick. Thomas says, Then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, unto his fellow disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. And that's the King James Version. In the Amplified Version of the Bible, it says, or the New Testament, it says, let us go too that we may be killed with him. So, you know, he gets a little bit of a bad rap, I think, doubting Thomas, but he was a brave guy. He was willing to follow Jesus, even though he thought Jesus was certain to die when he went to visit Lazarus. He may get picked on a little bit more for his doubt than he should, too. In the longer version of Mark, and when I say the longer version of Mark, I mean verses 6 to, the last chapter of Mark, verses 9 to 21, is not present in the early manuscripts of the New Testament, the Codex Sinaiticus and other manuscripts. The very, very earliest ones don't have the ending of Mark that we traditionally have today and use, those last few verses. But it's present in almost all the later manuscripts and almost every translation of the New Testament that's used by any Christian church today includes those verses. But most of them indicate that the verses weren't present in the earliest manuscripts that have been found. But anyway, in those verses, in the longer ending of Mark, the 11 disciples did not believe Mary's testimony when she comes and tells them what happened. When the two disciples on the road to Emmaus come, the longer ending of Mark tells us that the disciples didn't believe them either. And then when Jesus finally appears to them, he rebukes them as well for their unbelief and unwillingness to believe the testimony of others. So we tend to pick a little bit more on Thomas, perhaps, for his unbelief, but the other disciples were just as unbelieving as Thomas was. In fact, Peter had to run to the tomb himself. He wasn't willing to accept the testimony of Mary. And so I think, you know, when we talk about doubt in the New Testament, we tend to just think of the most famous person that's known for it, but we don't tend to think of the others who are also doubting as well. What I'd like to do now is just open up for a discussion, if you would, and help me out here. What are some of the conditions? We've looked at Thomas's. His condition was he wanted to touch and feel the Savior. What are some of the conditions that people can place on their willingness to believe today in the church? What are things that would be a condition for them? Something that, you know, it wouldn't be the exact same thing as Thomas, perhaps, but what are things that might dictate their willingness to believe? Go ahead and just raise your hand, whatever, and we'll just call in some people.
Maybe the ability to be critical and be acceptable at the same time. Because maybe they didn't accept Thomas in his time, I don't know, but he was critical. But he wanted hard evidence, right? He wanted to.
Okay, so Thomas wanted hard evidence in his time, and so you're saying that maybe somebody who's critical wants hard evidence today, that could be a condition that they place on their willingness to believe. All right. Go ahead.
Go back. He did actually get to touch and feel, though. He had these conditions, but he actually got to touch and feel.
Well, that's a very interesting point. Actually, it doesn't tell us that. It says that he believes. And this is something we're going to get to in just a minute. But that's good. It's good to bring out right now. He doesn't actually get to touch and feel, as far as we know. It doesn't tell us that he does. And so that's an interesting aspect, though. You think about that. You know, you think, well, sure, Thomas can believe. He got to touch and feel. What about me? But the interesting part of the story to me, and I'm glad you brought this up, is that Thomas doesn't touch and feel. Now he sees. That's a pretty big thing. But he doesn't get to touch and feel, apparently. He still believes. Jesus invites him to touch and feel. Thomas doesn't do it. He just says, I believe. Let's go ahead. Other things, conditions, or things like that. Think about that for a minute. That might be placed on the ability or willingness to believe today.
I'd say that things make at least a certain amount of sense.
So, for some people, they would want the gospel, the church, to make a certain amount of sense to be logical. Is that what you mean when you say a certain amount of sense? To be, what type of logic? I want to try and understand what you're saying here.
Well, I don't think any particular kind of logic, per se, but just to make sense
in the rationally,
exactly,
like in a scientific manner?
A legal thing.
Okay, all right. So for some people, they would want to have it make sense in a rational, scientific manner and not have to exercise as much faith. Am I understanding what you're saying? Okay. Let's go over here and then we'll come back to the back.
Be logical for a good life.
Be logical for a good life? Expand on what you're saying if you would, so I can understand.
Some things make sense because they work in your life. And if a church has a notion that makes your life bad, then that affects your ability to really believe.
Alright, so some things make sense because they work in your life. Can you give me an example, or if you want to, or would you rather not? I'm just trying to... I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
Word of wisdom things, word of wisdom things,
okay.
Education things.
Alright, so word of wisdom things. So, you could be, you know, maybe like a Starbucks or whatever, but
yeah.
Is that what you mean? And so that could be a condition on your willingness to believe, because you can't really partake of your Starbucks or whatever it is. Then you'd be less willing to believe.
I'm coming from the positive side.
Okay.
If it works logically, makes sense in your life, then it doesn't keep you from believing or doesn't make you consider not believing.
All right. So if it makes you happy, mm-hmm. if it works positively in your life, even though you don't understand it.
Yep.
Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay. So that's a condition and a response to the condition, a way perhaps around it or a way of evaluating it. We had a comment back here, and we'll come back there in front.
In recent times, we've become hung up on historical accuracy as opposed to mythic power of stories. Anciently, I don't think we were so concerned about the details of accuracy in the scriptures as what did this mean for your life and power and understanding.
All right, so it's possible the comment we had back here was that we get hung up in the historical accuracy of stories instead of considering the mythic power of the stories. In other words, considering the stories as they would anciently, perhaps, as a myth. I mean, you know, when you talk about Greek and Roman myths, for example, and you wonder how could somebody, I mean, the Romans were a pretty amazing civilization. The stuff that they built, they were so close to so many things. It would have been interesting if they'd gone on 200 more years what they would have come up with. And so, if considering it as they did, in other words, a mythic, the more mythic power of it, but also involves the power of faith. You're talking about believing in something that is rational. We have a comment, I think, all the way in the back.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, something more general. Data to the contrary. You know, things that just don't support or that counter-support what you believe, the data point that doesn't fit.
All right, so data to the contrary, which is a pretty general term. If we were going to get more specific with that, would we say perhaps historical things that happened in the church, like the Mountain Meadows Massacre? Are you referring to something like that?
No.
Are you thinking more of a policy in the church?
Yeah. Or genetic studies.
No. Okay,
yeah.
Okay, that's a good one. So your condition to believe might be preconditioned on the fact that, you know, there isn't very much or nil Middle Eastern DNA in Native Americans. I'm not trying to start an argument on that. I'm just trying to understand in the end when we're talking about faith. We have a comment over here and then we'll come back up to the front.
Well, my father, he went to church this week after meeting one vegetarian. He spoke on the word of wisdom. And to this day, he says, well, I'm just waiting for them to reveal that. I mean, he kept on, and when people would have a barbecue at the new board or something, he would, you know, they were thinking, because sometimes he would say in his old age, they weren't living the word of wisdom. So, but he still believed it.
That's right.
He's okay, I'm going to.
All right, so you still believe that's interesting. You met one vegetarian Mormon and joined the church because he thought everybody was after the Lord was. Well, we have a long ways to go. At least I do. Let's keep it for myself. Look at that and see. We're coming up. I think they're coming here and we'll take your turn.
I think going back where it says it makes sense or it has to work is kind of, as long as I'm getting the rewards, as long as everything is going well in my life, you know, the church says if you... you know, do family home evening, all your kids will stay in the church. You know, as long as those things are working, you believe. Those are your conditions. So you're getting the reward. So if things go badly, forget it.
All right. So as long as you're getting the reward, things are happy in your life, you feel satisfied in your life, things are going well in your life. How many of you does everything go perfectly in your life? How many of us? But that's the reward that often people are focusing on. You know, I pay my tithing, or I go to church, or whatever it is I do, and then my life will be happy and I won't have any problems. I think that's, when we talk about the mythic power of a story, that's a pretty large mythic power in that story. There's a lot of myth in that story, and a lot of power in it. Let's go ahead to here, and then we'll come back to your comment.
The secrecy of the church concerns me, and especially they call themselves a corporation, the corporation president, actually, the donation that you have to make it to. And then when they, 2 years ago, when they stopped revealing their financial aspects, you know, and took on more secrecy there, it's a question of the law. Are they really a religious organization, or are they a cult-like organization?
And there's no pun intended.
And if they were being more open and not secret about money of their dealings, I think a lot more people would be here.
So one condition that people can have on their faith is the secrecy that the church often seems to embrace. You know, I don't know, the sacredness that they might call it. But I think that's a valid point. You consider that people are willing to condition their belief, perhaps, because of the unwillingness to be for Christ. Am I understanding what you're saying? Okay, I think we have a comment here.
Being for Christ is
a way of judging things, is that what you're talking about? And then you evaluate that against your intrinsic experience? So that's another condition on that.
Thomas was involved with, or he wanted to be involved with sacredness, but he was also involved with secrets. Recently we've heard more about Thomas was privy to certain secret information.
Right.
I don't know.
Sure, but that's what Thomas, is that what you're referring to?
Right. So he, the way he was different, perhaps, among his fellow apostles, and he felt that he needed to capitalize on that information.
Well, that's a possibility. I'm not sure. How would that affect his faith? Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, he felt he was different.
Oh, because he had secrets. So, some people can condition their faith on their access to general authorities or their access to information inside the church. And if they have it, then they feel more likely that they have, I'm looking for a word here, a divine gift, I don't know, something that builds up their faith because they have that information.
I think one of the conditions would be the credibility of the person advancing, you know, the proposition. In other words, if it's in spiritual matters, I think there'd probably be a gradation between things that you were asked to believe from, say, the prophet versus, say, your bishop versus, say, your neighbor, as far as being the way it goes.
All right. I think that's an interesting gradation. So you might condition your belief on where you heard, the source that you heard from, the prophet. What was the next level? The bishop, your neighbor. You know, and obviously the neighbor's the one we're really going to trust, because he's right there.
I think it's interesting that nobody has mentioned the condition that seems to be the most common one, which is some sort of understandable and powerful spiritual manifestation of some kind, right? That I get something, right?
Right.
Whether it's, you know, an answer to a prayer or a dream or whatever, and that's what I base my belief. That's the condition of my belief.
I think that's probably a very fundamental one. Think about that in terms of a powerful spiritual manifestation, an answer to a prayer, a dream, an experience of some kind that becomes the basis of your condition for belief. I think that's a very fundamental one. Another one that I wanted to explore was, what about relationships with family members? Family members and members of the church, or versus those that are not. Relationships with ward members in your ward. Think of those in terms of conditioning belief on that. I don't know. I think for some people perhaps it does, but perhaps not. I'd like to hear your thoughts.
I think it certainly, without that, affects the participation in the church, because people have no longer come because they've been offended by, you know, someone else. But whether that was ever faith that they had, you know, and that.
Or
lost. Yeah, I have a question.
Well, that's a that's a good point. So is it a faith? I guess the question, if you don't mind, we'll just throw it out generally. Is it faith? Is that, let me see if I understand what you're saying. First of all, if somebody gets offended and quits going to church, do they? Are you saying that they didn't have faith?
Well, yeah,
because they got offended?
They had something they participated in. What I would say was more like the country club, or I don't know. And would it work more on a social basis?
So I think the social basis is what we were talking about. But certainly, that was for them. That was a condition of their faith. As much as you might look down on their faith and think that wasn't the faith of a spiritual manifestation, nevertheless, for them, that was their working faith in the church.
We also have the idea that for those who are born into a family that has any kind of religious dynamic to it, that you're going to be educated within that faith tradition, whatever that may be. So you get raised, or you can be raised, not necessarily one is, but you can be raised with a particular faith tradition that is imprinted on you, and then it's a question as to whether you embrace that tradition or do you seek some other faith tradition.
So you're raised with a faith tradition that can be imprinted on you. What would be a condition for believing in that faith tradition that's imprinted on you? What are some of the conditions someone might place on
your natural relationship with your parents? Do you feel loved and appreciated by your parents, and they believe you're going to naturally think, well, they know everything, they're giving me everything I need, so I will believe what they believe.
All right, so certainly the faith and the love and relationship with your parents will affect your ability in believing in that, since you received that from them. Am I understanding what you're saying?
I would add that I've been going to church all my life, and every month we have a testimony meeting where I get examples of what people's faith is and how they express that. So I get lots of examples throughout my whole life of what people believe, and that affects me. That helps me understand what I believe, and I articulate in conversation, often in silent conversation, with that expressed testimony, I'm kind of saying, yeah, me too, or no, I'm different, or and often that will shape me to have a certain kind of testimony.
All right, so our testimony, if I'm understanding what you're saying, is affected by what we listen to in testimony meetings, the experiences of others, for example. And we have, just as I'm sure many of you are having today, an internal dialogue with what's being spoken here. You know, we argue with ourselves all the time, or we evaluate and say yes or no. Let's just take a couple of minutes here, and wrapping up, I'd like to go back to the story that was brought up just a little bit earlier. The point was brought up, the common misperception is that Thomas got to fulfill the conditions of his belief, and he believed. But if you look closely at the story, Thomas doesn't actually put his hands on the side. I mean, Thomas says three things that he wants to do for his conditions of belief. Just take my word on that for right now, we won't go back and reread it. Let's think about now what I'd like to just think about in closing up here. What do you think are some of the reasons that people that have conditions no longer need those conditions to believe? Now, in Thomas's case, it was a dramatic spiritual manifestation. But nevertheless, Thomas had said, you know, I've got to touch and feel. I want to put my hand in the side. I want to do all this. But Thomas doesn't actually do that. Now he has a dramatic spiritual manifestation instead. And then the Savior invites him to. And Thomas just says, I believe. I don't need to do the things that I set out that I thought I needed to do. Can you think of people today, or in your own lives, or someone that you might know, that's had their conditions changed? Or have they ever changed in your life? Conditions that you thought you needed to believe, and why they might have changed. That's the end point of this that I would like to wrap up with right now. What are things that might change our conditions to believe? I mean, we set forth sometimes things that are our standards. But like Thomas, they might change as well. What are things that might affect that? That's what I want us to think about.
When your old standards don't work.
All right. When your old standards don't work, this is an interesting point. You're talking about, you have a standard that you're going to say, this is what I'll believe. When we get the full accounting, full open accounting, just like regular corporations do, you know, and the finances, then I'll believe. I'm not trying to say that would be your condition for belief, but I'm just trying to point that as an example of
a standard?
Sure.
Okay.
Maybe a very dramatic event that turns your life around, you get terminally ill and no longer wonder about critical questions, but you go more to the basics and go, I really don't need it anymore.
All right, so you might be turning more toward, you know, you could have a life-altering event. For some people, it might be terminally ill. We could talk about what some others might be as well. And that could cause you to change your perception or change your conditions for belief. Go ahead.
As I get older, I'm more and more able to live with doubt.
Now, that's interesting. So, as we age or mature, whatever we want to call it, we're able to live, you're able to tolerate more doubt in your life. Things that might have bothered you when you were younger, is that what you mean?
I was more idealistic when I was younger. And I wanted everything clean and tidy and all fixed up. Well, I comfortably think that's not the way it's going to be here, but I can accept that.
All right. So you can accept things that you couldn't accept previously because there's been some change.
Doubt.
Doubt. And the ability to live without. Well, we have more time. I'd like to go into that a little deeper, but let's take some other comments too.
A person can go through such a dramatic shift in the way they perceive what is really important in reality that not only do they not need answers to the old questions, but the old questions are absurd.
So a person can go through such a dramatic shift that the old questions that it seems so important, it even seems absurd to them at this point because of something that's happened to them. Let's take that comment right here in the back. This will be our last one.
Okay, next one too.
We'll take both of them then.
I think doubt has great value if you put it in the context of human development. You have your one stage in your life, you have to then doubt things about that stage to move to the next stage. Make you develop or look for beyond where you were before. The second thing is, I think it really comes together when a person sort of falls in love with God and experiences the joy of experiencing the divine, then the rational details start to fall away and don't matter as much.
So we have stages that we like in a progression in your first part of your comment. Is that what you mean, that you move through in life?
You start out very dualistic, and then you start doubting the dualism, you know, there's right and wrong, and you start looking at pluralism, and so on. You have to start doubting the old paradigm.
So you go through that sense of doubt, but then also you said it was an embracing of God, of love, and then feeling the joy that comes from that. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, the old scientific details aren't quite as important.
It's interesting, people talk about their ability to know something. And they say, how can someone know something when they feel something? I think that's a fairly common one. But, you know, what you're talking about here is the feeling of love. And how do you know if you're loved? You feel it. And no, that's what you're talking about. How do you know if you're not loved and you're offended? You decide not to attend anymore because you feel it inside. It's also a feeling. When someone decides not to participate because they were offended, it's also a feeling that they have. I'd like to thank you for your comments today. I really enjoyed learning from you and exploring a little bit of the story of Thomas. And I hope that you've been able to reflect and learn some things as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. It occurred to me as we were having this discussion that the fact that the rather minor figure of Thomas in the New Testament has come down to us through the generations with this image of doubting Thomas tells us that we have a lot in the back of our minds that we still need to talk about. So thank you for helping us move that discussion along. If for anybody who might be interested,